Trust Exercise by I. Groxbach, read by CookieMom6067. Captain, I do not understand the purpose of the team-building activity. Spock's voice is dry and clipped as ever, but Una thinks she detects a hint of plaintiveness underneath. The purpose, Mr. Spock, is to learn more about your fellow crew members. Chris's voice is friendly but firm, the textbook perfect Starfleet captain. Yes, that is the stated purpose of the exercise. However, as I memorized a fact about each crew member last night, I believe my time would be better used for scientific research. Ensign Aberg recently adopted a pet tarantula. Lieutenant Bartholomew believes she will die without cheese, a hyperbolic statement indicating her fondness for dairy products. Yeoman Chow has a twin sister who lives on Enough Spock. Chris waves a hand. The point is to interact with your fellow crew members in a non-duty setting to build interpersonal relationships. Una makes a mental note to avoid Ensign Aberg's quarters. She's not scared of spiders, but she definitely wouldn't choose to interact with them recreationally. Isn't that right, Number One? Yes, absolutely, Una agrees. She's not actually sure what she's agreeing to. She'd tuned out the rest of Pike's monologue about the importance of Starfleet-mandated team-building. Spock takes one of the old-fashioned paper maps from Pike's hand. I have already developed excellent orienteering skills during my Kazwan, a Vulcan coming-of-age ritual requiring desert survival. That's exactly what Starfleet is hoping you'll share with the rest of the crew. Chris's grin doesn't waver. Una sighs and snatches another map, then trades her communicator for an old-fashioned flare gun. Come on, Spock, she says. Let's say the two of us get this out of the way as quickly as possible, and we'll both be back to our research in no time. She flashes Pike a smile that's nigh on insubordinate, although there's nobody else around to see. I love mandatory Starfleet fun. Spock narrows his eyes and instructions on the back of the map. We must collect 5 flowers, a stick longer than your arm, an object smaller than your thumb, 10 leaves, and 1 live insect. Then we must use the map to locate the blue base camp beacon. Motherfucker! Una doesn't swear a lot, but when she does, it's because Starfleet demands that she bond with her crew by finding insects on a planet famous for its low concentration of animal life. I find it most intriguing that Captain Pike did not select a partner. Spock squints into the distance. He appears to be eating a sandwich. Of course he is. She'd bet it's roast beef, and he didn't even bring one for her. We have 2 choices, Spock. 1, we ignore the rules, finish as fast as we can, and go about our day. Spock nods. I see the merits of this decision. Alternatively, we go the petty route. We collect Captain Pike and make him suffer along with us. Spock cocks an eyebrow. It is unfortunate the captain was unable to find a suitable partner. It is only logical that we invite him to join our team. Una beams. Petty it is. Oh no, I dropped the object smaller than my thumb, Una says for the 5th time in the last hour. Chris turns around. She sees his jaw clench before he forces his facial expression into captainly professionalism. Una, I've told you several times, putting things in your pocket isn't against the rules. Pockets are not technology. Una shrugs innocently. I'm only trying to do it like our most ancient ancestors. They probably didn't have pockets. Perhaps you could hold the commander's flower collection, Spock suggests helpfully. Una beams. Yes, please. Spock's obviously figured out that Chris forgot his allergy tabs. A glorious floral bouquet is the last thing he wants to carry. Chris's jaw clenches again. Of course, that will make it much easier for Commander Chin Riley to keep track of this pebble. She makes a show of checking it against her thumb. Yes, this is just the right size. I'll do my best to hold on to it. Spock is in charge of the stick longer than her arm. He leans against it and does a shockingly good job at feigning surprise when it snaps in half. The wood on this planet is very weak, he says. Una picks up both halves of the stick and compares them carefully to the length of her arm. Nope, she says, tossing one broken half into the woods. She shakes her head ruefully. Not this one either. They're both too short. Chris's face flushes an odd shade of purplish red that Una's only seen once in their long friendship. She thinks she can hear his teeth grinding together, although maybe that's just wishful thinking. Okay, I get it, he snaps. You don't want to do this. I don't want to do this. I told Starfleet the Enterprise doesn't need team building. They didn't listen, so now here we are. Please, just collect nature and learn a fact about each other. Commander Chin Riley has collected profanity in 176 languages, Spock supplies. Her favorite terms involve sexual acts with one's mother. Chris pinches the bridge of his nose. An interesting fact about you is that you lost a bet with Ortegas last night, so you excused her from the team-building exercise. The two of you are going to go joyriding around the canyon together after everyone left, Una says. Then, in case it's not obvious, she adds, that's why I'm torturing you. Chris holds up a hand. Okay, okay. I've learned you two are very good at malicious compliance. Una clucks her tongue. You should have known that about me already. Well, I didn't know about Spock, Chris says. If I had, I would obviously have made different choices today. Is there some way I can make it up to you? I want the rest of the sandwich, Una says immediately. She knows at least half is left. Chris nods. Done. Spock, there's meat in the sandwich, but I can offer you. He searches around in his pockets. Dried fruit? My breakfast provided adequate sustenance. However, I understand food is a common human peace offering, Spock says, accepting a baggie of dried cranberries that Una would certainly not have been satisfied with. Chris gestures expansively at a little circle of flat rocks at their feet. I'm sure we'll all feel better after a snack. Una glances at the circle of rocks. It really doesn't look natural, but that's a curiosity she can investigate later. She has a sandwich to eat, thank you very much. The moment her bottom touches the stone, she knows she's made a mistake. The ground rumbles and fractures, and suddenly the three of them are tumbling downward into the earth. Congratulations, you have unlocked the secret entrance, a computerized voice announces. Motherfucker, she says. Anyone injured? Chris is back on his feet first, clearly in emergency mode. I lost my sandwich, Una reports. That's an injury. Spock silently offers her the baggie of cranberries, which he had somehow managed to hold on to. None of them are armed, but they automatically stand back to back, forming a defensive triangle while they look around. Entrance is sealed, Una reports. There is a large but antiquated computer display on the north wall, Spock adds. I don't see any sign of life. Chris breaks out of this triangle, apparently satisfied that nothing immediately wants to kill them. Spock, I thought this planet was uninhabited. Archaeological surveys indicate a complex civilization vanished over 1,000 years ago. Spock inclines his head toward the computer display. We are likely viewing the remnants. Then who is talking, Una asks, and why do they speak English? I am programmed to decode a variety of linguistic inputs, a pleasant female voice announces. I have been listening to your conversation. That's not creepy, Una says. You are employing antiphrasis, a rhetorical device of saying the opposite of what is meant, Spock says. I prefer to call it sarcasm. Chris smacks her on the arm and points at the computer display, which is now broadcasting blinking colored lights. I think we found our voice. To unlock the exit, you must share a memory, the computer announces. A small door slides open, revealing a glowing metal ball. Please place your hand on the memory keeper to proceed. The hell I will, Una says. It is unfortunate. The parameters of the team-building exercise prohibited tricorders, Spock says pointedly. A scan would allow us to ascertain the safety of the procedure. Chris spins slowly around the room. It looks like it might have been a bunker at one point, although the tiled walls have cracked with age and gnarled roots are poking through the concrete floor. I don't see a whole lot of options besides compliance, he says. It'll be hours before anyone realizes we're missing, and who knows how many other people might get sucked into these in the meantime. I have conducted anatomical scans. The memory keeper poses no threat, the computer informs them. That's exactly what an evil supercomputer would say, Una points out. I am an archival device. Everyone is safe inside the memory library, the computer responds, sounding slightly aggrieved. Chris shrugs. If it's a lie, it's a really weird one. Una sighs. Chris looks a little too excited for his own good. New life, new civilizations, exchanging memories with a strange piece of technology. If a horse were involved, this experience would be all his favorite things rolled into one. I can't stop you from doing this, can I? Una says. Chris is already halfway across the room. I'll test it with one finger first. Una resists the urge to point out how dirty that sounds. If things get weird, I'm pulling you off. Spock, stand by to disable the orb. Chris carefully lays the pad of one finger against the ball. Blue ripples expand outward across the surface, and the screen on the wall flickers. This transmission could not be received. Please place your hand on the memory keeper in order to share a memory. On the count of three, Una says, readying herself to yank him back from the orb. Spock nods, and Chris obliges her with the countdown, but nothing terrible happens when he puts his hand on the orb. The whole surface glows blue, and the computer screen comes to life. Audience members, please turn to view the memory. It takes Una a minute to understand that the screen is showing her the world through Chris's eyes. At the bottom of the frame, she can see his hands. They're covered with a layer of dust, and they're entirely too small. A boy's hands. Predictably, they're holding the reins of a chestnut-colored horse. Above them, the sun is sinking rapidly behind the horizon, leaving a trail of pink and gold over the desert sands. Chris dismounts and drops a bedroll onto a rock, standing beside the horse as the last traces of light vanish from the sky. "See, boy, this is what we came for," he whispers to the horse, pointing at the first star on the horizon. Soon the sky is inky black, punctuated by the glittering light of uncountable stars. A feeling of peace washes over Una, like she's there in the memory right along with him. But unease tugs at the back of her brain. A boy his age shouldn't be alone in the desert. There's a faint sound beyond the shifting sand and the horse's gentle breathing, like two people are shouting at each other, but their voices fade in and out. Chris yanks his hand off the orb, and the display goes dark before Una figures out what they're saying. Thank you for sharing. This memory has been rejected because it is incomplete, the computer chirps brightly. Chris opens and closes his mouth, looking indignant. That's the night I decided to join Starfleet. I don't know what else you want. This memory has been rejected because it is incomplete, the computer repeats, and Una thinks of the people shouting in the background. Obviously, he'd cut off the memory before it finished. Not that she blames him. Whatever happened next wasn't the computer's business. Training tape 001 has become stuck. Please assist. A flashing yellow light appears underneath the screen, next to a bank of dusty memory tapes. Spock examines it carefully. Captain, with your permission. Have at it, Spock. Can't hurt to watch the training video. Spock pushes the tape into the slot, and the computer screen comes to life again. Una catches her breath. Now they're standing on a battlefield, looking through the eyes of a soldier. She can see leathery, scale-covered hands, loading a gun before an explosion splits the sky. The soldier dives for cover, and when he comes up, his companion's shattered body is lying among the rocks. Footage of the battle keeps rolling while the narration begins. The war without end began 1,500 years ago. For over two centuries, our people destroyed this world and each other. In desperation, a group of scientists developed the Memory Keepers. Rival bands of soldiers were trapped together, and when they witnessed one another's memories, they lost the desire to kill. Peace was forged, but our planet was ravaged. The warring sides departed together in search of a better world, but the memory keepers remain behind to serve all those who require their assistance. The final visual swings back and forth from a spaceship launch to memories of distant battlefields and lost friends. It's the last person aboard the ship, Una says quietly. It's the last memory on this planet. They're remembering the launch and all the battles that led up to it. It's hard to finish the sentence around the lump in her throat. Beside her, Spock is nodding. Pre-Surak, some Vulcan philosophers argued that mind melds could be a tool for attaining peace. It didn't work? Chris asks. Spock shakes his head. Mind melds require a level of trust that is unlikely to exist between warring factions. In this case, the computer provided a neutral intermediary that allowed enemy groups to share memories safely. It worked because they shared whole memories, the good and bad parts, Una says. The final reel has been playing on a loop, still moving back and forth from the launch celebration to more distant memories of the battlefield. This is an example of a complete memory, the computer confirms. Chris swallows. I can do that. Una can tell he doesn't want to, and she stops him with a hand on his shoulder. Let me take the hit this time, Chris. I don't mind. Chris looks at her skeptically. She doesn't blame him. Vulnerability isn't normally her strong suit, but now she feels a strange pull towards the orb. I've hidden so much. Now I'd like to share. Chris squeezes her shoulder. Thank you. Una places her hand on the orb, but she doesn't turn to see the image on the screen. She already knows what it will show. Her hands holding the rejection letter from the Illyrian Exploratory Force. I'm sorry, the mistress is saying. The Force rarely has openings for applicants from politically unconnected backgrounds. For orphans, Una hears herself say. Babies left on the street like trash. Her people had accomplished so much, but they'd never learned to eliminate whatever flaw would make someone abandon their baby. With your mind, you'd make an excellent school teacher or even a veterinarian, the mistress says, trying to put a bright face on it. With enough courses and advanced certifications, you'd be almost like a doctor. Una knows they can't see it in the video, but she can feel her teeth grinding as her younger self wipes the application brochures from the mistress's data pad. I'm going to the stars, and that's that. The memory skips ahead, and Una's on a spaceship. It's a garbage trawler, and she'd done a year of hard labor to afford the berth, and 2 years after that to buy the documents that would carry her into the Federation. She's looking out the tiny porthole in the head, watching the lavender skies of her homeworld recede into the distance. She still remembers the exact moment she'd wrenched her eyes away from the view and focused on her reflection in the scuffed bathroom mirror. My name is Una Chen Riley. I'm from the uranium mines on Colony 1065. My parents named me Una because it sounds like the number one. When she turns back to the porthole, her planet's gone, replaced by a view of her new home, the stars. She knows it's a complete memory, and she can take her hand away from the orb now. Probably she should stop here if she's being honest with herself, but she doesn't want to. Now she speeds the memories up. Vignettes of dozens of team-building and friendship exercises over the years flash on the screen. Chris and Spock will see her looking longingly at other teams laughing in the distance, swapping stories about their homeworlds, looking like a page from a Starfleet recruitment brochure. They'll see her turn towards someone else on the periphery, someone stern and businesslike who only wants to get the exercise done with fast. And after that, they'll see her turning down a dozen dates and a dozen offers for Friday night poker games and hear the other cadets whisper, "She's a lost cause. She doesn't want to make friends." Finally, she comes to the last memory. Chris and La'an and Spock collecting her from the prison colony with a pardon letter and some harebrained story about not quite kidnapping the president of the Federation. The screen goes dark when Chris swoops in for a hug, and she buries her face in his shoulder for a little too long. The screen shifts again, and she's coming back to the Enterprise. The ship goes blurry when her eyes fill up and snaps back into focus again when she wipes away the tears. When she steps off the shuttle, there's one frame where she can see the whole crew lined up in the corridor, saluting her return, and everything goes hopelessly blurry after that. That was when she'd given up on hiding the tears. At last, she takes her hand away from the orb. The bunker's quiet, but not in a bad way. Chris has been crying, which she expected, and Spock gives her a live long and prosper salute. Then the computer says, "Thank you. This memory is complete." Una waits for the hatch and the ceiling to open, but nothing happens. Do you require assistance or maintenance to open the bunker? Una asks the screen. The last blurry visual of the Enterprise crew dissolves, replaced by the familiar swirling lights. All group members must share a memory. Oh, come on! Una gives the bottom of the console a little kick. Forced vulnerability is asinine. Vulnerability is a prerequisite for peace, the computer replies. Una plans to argue back. Chris clearly doesn't want to do this, and the computer probably isn't programmed to deal with a species like Vulcans, who don't express emotion like everyone else. Spock holds up a hand before she can open her mouth. I will do that which is required, he says formally. Is that what Vulcan kids say when their parents make them do homework? Chris asks, grinning. Spock only raises an eyebrow. Vulcan children do not have to be forced to learn. He places his hand on the orb, and the screen flickers to life. Una sees Lady Amanda and Ambassador Sarek seated at a large formal dining table. It must be a childhood memory, because the hand gripping Spock's fork is so small. I will complete the Kazwan during the next lunar cycle, he announces. Amanda gasps. Spock, don't be silly, you're 7. Most people complete the ritual at 11 or 12, right, Sarek? We must hear the child's reasons for the decision before passing judgment, Sarek says, continuing to eat. I believe my peers will accept me as Vulcan if I complete the traditional coming-of-age ritual early, Spock says without a trace of emotion. His logic is sound, Sarek agrees. Amanda looks outraged. The Kazwan is dangerous. People get hurt every year. Sometimes they die. You can't risk your life just to fit in, she glares at Sarek, and you can't let him. This is not a matter for us to decide. Sarek still hasn't put down his knife and fork. He will complete the requisite wilderness survival courses. If his grades are unsatisfactory, he is not ready for the test and will not participate. However, if the instructor concludes that I am prepared, it is illogical to refuse me the opportunity, Spock finishes. Amanda leaves her chair and crouches next to Spock. This will be the hardest thing you've ever done. Are you sure it's worth it, just to feel accepted? Yes. Spock's answer is firm, and he looks away when his mother's eyes fill with tears. The image shifts, and now Spock is climbing the stairs toward his bedroom. Down below, they can hear his mother yelling, followed by his father's emotionless responses. Young Spock lingers on the stairs like he's trying to decide whether to listen, but finally he speeds toward his room. The sound turns fuzzy when he shoves a pair of earplugs into his ears. When the image shifts again, Spock is standing on the edge of a desert. Heat waves ripple across the screen. Una is struck again by how small Spock is. He has to crane his neck to look at the boy next to him. Remember, the Kazwan is a test of ethics above all else, a solemn-faced instructor intones. Though you will enter the desert without food, water, or weapons, you must not succumb to the temptation to eat meat or to steal what other participants need to survive. Una hears a steady thudding in the background and realizes it's the sound of Spock's heart beating in his ears. He's afraid. The sound intensifies when the instructor says, "This is a test of individual survival. Overcoming obstacles and injuries is the responsibility of each participant. If you see that someone is incapacitated, note their coordinates and inform an adult at the end of the test." The memory fast-forwards again, and Spock is in the desert. Beads of sweat drip down his forehead, obscuring his vision. Una hears the sound of something heavy skidding over the sand, and she realizes Spock is pulling something behind him. It's a sledge crudely fashioned from dried grass, and another much larger boy lays atop it. Thick green blood mats his hair. Spock holds a water bottle up to the light, gauging how much is left, then turns to dribble the last few drops into the wounded boy's mouth. Soon Spock is nearing the periphery of the field. A crowd of adults stands just beyond the rope barrier. Though their faces are impassive, several of them strain forward, scanning to see whether their child has survived. Spock nearly collapses at the finish line, but he pulls himself up when the instructor appears. I have broken protocol, he says. Stan would not have survived without my intervention. All life has inherent worth, Yet passing this test has only instrumental worth. Saving him was therefore my obligation. The instructor looks impressed, but several of the children at the finish line fail to disguise their looks of contempt. A logical rationalization for his emotional desire to play the hero, one of them mutters, and the rest of the crowd nods along. Spock looks down at the sand, and though Una doesn't think the memory keeper has a telepathic component, she swears she feels him surrendering any hope of ever fitting in. At last, he pulls his hand back from the orb, and the screen goes dark. His face is impassive as ever, and Una wonders if he'd prefer for her to pretend that none of this has ever happened. But she raises her hand in a Vulcan salute. Spock meets her eyes, and the corner of his mouth twitches faintly, as if he'd almost grinned. It is not logical, but sometimes we can only find home by leaving our birthplace. He returns his hand to the orb, and a picture of the Enterprise appears on the screen, shimmering among the stars. The final group member will share a memory, the computer says, and Una rolls her eyes. I understand you believe vulnerability is required for peace, she says, forcing herself to speak civilly. But we're not at war. I propose a compromise. I'll share another memory in place of the captain. That should fulfill the requirements and serve as proof we're not fighting. I wouldn't offer to go in his place if we were engaged in conflict. The computer's lights turn on and off one by one, like it's thinking. Una's made a good point, obviously. But before she can press her case, Chris steps forward, laying a hand on her shoulder. It's okay, Una. His smile wavers, but only for a few seconds. Anyway, you know me. I'd never ask my crew to do something I'm not willing to do myself. Soon the Mojave is back on the screen. Chris is lying down, looking at the stars, and Una hears muffled yelling in the background. It takes her a minute to realize that the memory isn't in sequence. The younger Chris on the screen is remembering why he left home in the first place. Soon the image wavers and Chris's childhood bedroom appears. Una's surprised how bare it looks. The walls are plain, and there's a pile of boxes in the corner. She remembers him saying his family moved to Arizona for a reset when he was 9, although he'd never said what exactly required resetting. Now Una can guess. The screaming is loud and clear, like it's coming from the next room, although it's so fast and shrill she can barely pick out individual words. Occasionally she hears something shatter, like somebody had thrown a plate. Chris climbs out the window and drops onto the ground with a muffled thud. Based on how the image wavers, Una thinks he might have fallen or come close to it, but he doesn't stop or look behind him. The target comes into view quickly, a simple barn made from sheets of scrap metal. The horse looks much too fast and sleek for a 9-year-old, but Chris clearly knows what he's doing. Una figures this is only one of many illicit nighttime rides. Don't worry. You won't get in trouble, boy, Chris tells the horse, fitting the saddle over its broad back. They never notice when I leave. Una had refused to watch her own memory, but Chris is watching his. Now his cheeks flush pink. It's not the same as what you two went through, he says, sounding apologetic. Don't start with that, Una says sharply. That moment made you. She can see the aftermath in everything Chris does. The boy whose parents never noticed him leave became the captain who makes everyone feel seen. The boy who listened to his parents shout became a negotiator who could look at everything from every side and the kindest, most empathetic friend she's ever known. This memory is complete, the computer says. You may remove your hand from the memory keeper. No, thank you, Chris says. The image on the screen shifts through memory so fast Una can barely process it. Spock yanking him back from the edge of a cliff. Una knocking him out of the way of a blast grenade. Literary debates in the mess hall. Silent drinks after missions gone wrong. Exploring new planets together. Treating each other's wounds. Long conversations in the empty hours between missions. There is no narrative thread to follow, but the meaning is clear. Una and Spock are his family, and the Enterprise is home. At last, the screen goes dark. Thank you. Your memories will be stored for future generations, the computer announces. You may exit through the hatch in the ceiling. Please use caution when climbing the ladder. Una manages a strangled laugh at that, which gives her an excuse to wipe her eyes. Chris, of course, wedges himself between her and Spock, bumping his shoulders against theirs. In the reflection of the computer screen, Una thinks they look like a family holo, the kind she used to envy on her academy roommate's nightstand. For decades, Una's seen herself as an officer who earned her place through extraordinary skill, someone who had to remain useful to keep a place on the team. Now looking at the three of them standing shoulder to shoulder, she sees something else. Three people who left their birthplace to find their home and created a family with each other. They didn't save her from prison because they needed her. They did it because they love her. The end.